From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been a dramatic day for world markets. Jeremy, CNN's been covering it, as you know, blow by blow like a hurricane. It was a hurricane in the world of finance. It started with a crash in China. The country's main index fell nearly 9%, wiped out all the gains from the entire year.
And that drop reverberated through markets in Europe and Japan and the U.S., the Dow dropping more than 1,000 points at the open on Wall Street this morning. It has since recovered much of that loss. Let's take a look at what's happening, though, and what it means for Americans invested in the stock market, either through a stock fund that they have or through maybe a 401k or retirement account. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News joins us from New York. Hi, Jill.
Good afternoon.
And I think it's worth, first of all, just reminding people what's going on here. So what is driving this huge drop?
Well, this really started to gather some steam last week where we were focused on what's going on in China. Now, you probably didn't realize it, but from the middle of 2014 to the middle of 2015, the Chinese stock market doubled. I mean, it was on a tear. And part of that was because the government was really prompting people to buy stocks. And it was trying to help the economy along. But there were concerns. There were some cracks in that. And the stock market started to sell off in China. And then we started to get some reports of an economic slowdown in China. That's what caught the attention of traders. The fear is that China, the second largest economy in the world, if they're going to slow down, won't that slow the rest of the world down in the U.S.? And if the world's slowing down, how are companies going to make money? Oh my gosh, we haven't had a correction in 4 years. Sell everything. And that's really where we got to it when we woke up this morning.
So what would you tell ordinary people to do with their accounts as they watch big drops like this in the stock market?
You know, I used to be a money manager and a financial planner, right, and I would get these panic-stricken calls from people on days like today. And you know what? It's such old advice, but it really works. Calm down. Don't do anything. Sit still. Because frankly, for most people, you're walking into a session and you see, oh my God, the Dow drops 1,000 points this morning. And that is scary. But what does that mean if you're a long-term investor? What does this one day signify? Probably not much. For most people, they've got diversified portfolios. They don't have all their money in stocks. For most people, you don't need your money for a while. And hopefully, you are actually kind of rooting for the stock market to go down if you're continuing to contribute to your retirement account or education funds because you are buying shares at lower prices. So it's really boring advice to say, keep cool, stick to your game plan, but it actually works.
Well, what about taking it a step further? Instead of just don't do anything, should people buy now?
You know, you know, the old story of don't try to catch a falling knife is an old trading aphorism, you know. Who knows where the bottom is? I mean, I can look back on today and say, gosh, you should have bought it when we were down 1,000 points because we're only down 150. You know, like, but that's silly. The only reason you were going to buy today is if you were lucky enough that you happened to say, hey, I'm putting money in my kid's 529 account, and today was the day you actually put the money in and bought. Nobody knows where the top is and the bottom is, and that's why sticking to some discipline, some game plan really will serve you best. Trying to figure out when to throw money into the market and when not, it's really a fool's errand. There's no proof that anyone knows how to time the market.
Now, we're hearing today from Diane Swank, the chief economist at Mesirow Financial in Chicago, who's got a very good ear on what's going on at the Fed, that the Fed is going to come out at some point this week through the signals that they give and basically make clear that they are not going to raise interest rates next month, as had been widely expected. Interest rates have been near zero now since the financial crisis. But what does that mean for people about going, if that indeed happens, what does that mean about, you know, the housing market and all that?
It's like the plume of smoke going up from the Vatican.
Right.
The Fed will send us a signal and we will know. You know, I think that would be a mistake for the Fed, because I'm not sure that there's any evidence right now that we are seeing a slowdown in the U.S. economy. And so I think that for the Fed to come out and start to say to the market, don't worry, we got your back, is almost silly, because obviously, if things deteriorate, the economy deteriorates, the Fed will wait to raise interest rates. But if there is not a clue, if we get a housing report, we're going to get a couple of housing reports out, and we're going to get a jobs report out next week. And if that jobs report is strong and oil has dropped down at $40 a barrel and there's savings at the pumps, I'm not exactly sure what the rationale is for the Fed that has told us time and time again that it doesn't look at the stock market. It's not controlled by the stock market. I mean, heck, we could end this day where we started down 1,000 points up on the session. And then what's the Fed going to do then? So I think it would be a bit dangerous for the Fed to wade in those waters. I think it's certainly possible. They don't want to make a mistake here. This is a big policy change. Maybe we'll get some clues out of this big symposium out in Jackson Hole. But I wish the Fed wouldn't actually put that signal out there, because I think it would be healthier for markets.
Jill Schlesinger with CBS News joining us from New York. Jill, thank you so much as always.
Take care.
I wrote down what she said. Don't try to catch a falling knife. Financial advice there about buying falling stocks. But try to tell that to the three Americans and the British man who received the French Legion of Honor today for thwarting that attack by an armed gunman on a train from Amsterdam to Paris. The three Americans, Anthony Sadler, Alex Garlatos, and Spencer Stone, are childhood friends. Spencer Stone is in the Air Force. Alex Garlatos is a member of the Oregon National Guard. He just returned from a tour in Afghanistan. But over the weekend, they both said that military training did not kick in until after they just got up.
I mean, I didn't really have much of a state of awareness. It wasn't really a conscious decision. We just kind of acted. There wasn't much thinking going on, at least on my end. I don't know about them. Spencer?
No, I don't know.
No thinking, not at all. And our next guest says that in acts of extreme altruism, that's usually the case. If you've ever wondered, what would I do faced with the same situation? He may have the answer. Yale psychology professor David Rand co-authored the recent study, Risking Your Life Without a Second Thought, Intuitive Decision-Making and Extreme Altruism. And professor, who did you study and what did you find?
So what we did for this paper is we collected interviews that Carnegie Hero Medal recipients, people who risked their lives to save strangers, did with different news media at the time that they did their heroic acts. And then we analyzed the text of those interviews.
And what did they say?
Almost across the board, they said that they didn't think, they just acted quickly, they went with their gut.
Here's some of the quotes. Lenny Skutnik, who was the man who jumped into the Potomac to rescue victims of an airplane crash, he said, it was a human reaction. It was like breathing, like walking. I didn't think. Another man who rescued a woman said, it was like a bolt of lightning. Something hit me. As opposed to what? What's the opposite of that kind of thinking?
So the opposite of that kind of intuitive thinking is what we call reflective or deliberative thinking. And it's things where you carefully calculate out the odds, or you use self-control, you use willpower. And so what could have happened in a situation is you could imagine that you see a bad thing happening, like in the context of the train, you see the gunman on the train and you think, oh no, I'm scared. If I attack him, I might get hurt, but if it's going to save all these people, it's really the right thing to do. I've got to make myself do it.
In other words, if you take that much time to think that one sentence through, you probably won't do it?
Exactly. Yeah. And not because it's too late. In our study, we controlled for the amount of time they had to act, but rather it's that psychologically, once you start thinking like that, you start coming up with excuses and rationalizations for why you don't have to act.
Well, and your brain will receive that as you could get hurt, or, you know, someone else could get hurt. You call this the danger of deliberation, that you'll delay and won't do it. But it's exactly what we're told to do.
Right. And it's the thing that is in your own self-interest. You know, this is a funny situation where deliberation that usually works very well for you, it still works very well for you personally, but it has these unintended negative consequences for other people.
Well, and you told the Washington Post, you're not taking sides on this, whether people should act or not. When you say danger of deliberation, you're not, you know, commenting on whether or not people should react. But given what we know about why they react, you know, without thinking, what can we learn from this?
I think it teaches us something about human nature and the way to think about altruism, which is that where the altruistic desire to help others typically comes from is a sort of automatic conditioned response. My idea is that in everyday situations, when someone asks you to help, it's typically a small stakes thing that you can easily afford to do that will help them and then will come back to benefit you in the future, because then they'll be positively inclined towards you. So you get in the habit of helping people and you develop this kind of intuitive, cooperative impulse. And then in a high stakes situation, your first response is to just keep treating it like daily life and say, oh, I should help. And then if you stop and think about it, you're like, oh, wait, no, this is really different. This is a bad idea.
So in other words, you can train yourself not to think about it. If in fact you want to be one of those people, if you want to be, you know, someone when tested who could do something heroic, you're suggesting that it may be possible to cultivate a willingness to act.
I think so, although there's an important point here, which is there's two different things that both need to line up for people to act. They have to be willing to go with their gut, but they also have to have the cooperative gut response in the first place. Because if you have someone whose initial impulse is to not help, then that person is definitely not going to help. So we have done a number of studies on how you can train your impulses to be cooperative. And that's a sort of first step that needs to happen. And then you also need to be willing to go with that cooperative impulse. And I think there's much less research on how to get yourself to be more impulsive. Because in general, being impulsive is not desirable for you.
Right. David Rand, he's a professor at Yale, teaches psychology, economics, and management. Professor Rand, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's been a lot of talk on the campaign trail about immigration, so we are going to spend this week looking at our immigration system, starting with the numbers. Mark Rosenblum is deputy director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. He's with us from Washington. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and let's start with legal immigration first. Who are the legal immigrants coming into this country? Where are they coming from?
So legal immigrants to the United States come from mostly from Latin America and from Asia. There are a total of about 41 million foreign-born in the United States today, and about two-thirds of them are here legally.
And how does it break down between high-skill and low-skilled workers coming in legally?
So employment-based immigrants who come in as workers actually only account for about a sixth of all legal immigrants. And almost all of the employment-based immigrants are high-skilled. There's very few visas for low-skilled immigrants. And high-skilled immigrants tend to come from Asia, mostly from China and India. But there's some diversity in that high-skilled population also.
And how long do they have to wait to go through the process to come into the U.S. legally?
Well, most employment-based immigrants, high-skilled immigrants, actually enter the country initially either as a student or on a temporary visa. And there aren't tremendous waits to get one of those temporary visas, although there are limits to how many of those visas are offered every year. Where the really long waits exist is to transition from a temporary visa to a permanent visa. And for employment-based immigrants, for high-skilled workers, that wait can be between 6 years up to maybe 10 years.
10 years just to get the visa.
Right. But in many cases, those are people who are in the U.S. waiting to get a permanent visa.
So what are they doing in the meantime? Are they illegal or are they legal while they're waiting?
Well, a lot of the employment-based immigrants enter as a student, and then they may transition from being a student to having what's called an H-1B visa, which is an employment-based high-skilled visa. And so they're working lawfully on a temporary visa for 6 to 10 years while their employer sponsors them for that green card. And many of the people with those temporary visas never do get sponsored. And then some of them do become unauthorized because if their temporary visa runs out or their student visa runs out, there are definitely high-skilled immigrants who overstay their visas and become unauthorized.
You mentioned that the people who are coming in legally right now are generally coming from Asia and Latin America. How has that changed over the years?
Well, that's been the trend since about 1970, but it's a huge change from historical patterns. In 1960, 75% of the foreign-born population was from Europe, and only 12% were from Asia. And today, only 12% are from Europe, and 30% are from Asia, and about 54% from Latin America.
And what does that tell you, just that economic conditions are comparatively better here than in the places where people want to come from, and whereas in Europe, things might be pretty good, so they're not coming here as much?
Well, so economic factors are definitely one big driver of immigration. People move to improve their economic circumstances. They also move to be reunited with families with earlier waves of immigrants. The big change that happened that triggered this transition around 1970 was a legal reform change to U.S. immigration law that was passed in 1965, 50 years ago this year, that opened up legal immigration from Asia, which had previously been very tightly restricted. So the reason we had so few Asian immigrants was that the law forbade most Asian immigrants, and we've seen pretty steady increases since that 1965 legislation.
Let's talk about what's going on illegally.
Well, there are currently about 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. About a little over half of them are from Mexico, and then another 15% or so are from Central America. So over 70, just over 70% are from Mexico and Central America. About 14% are from Asia. It's the next largest region of origin.
And when we say they're coming in illegally, how does that work out? Are they really crossing the border on foot? Are they flying in and overstaying visas?
About half, between half and two-thirds of unauthorized immigrants enter illegally, crossing the border or sneaking through a port of entry. And between a third and half enter legally on a temporary visa and then overstay their visa.
So building a wall would do nothing about those people.
That's right. Building a wall will do nothing about those people, and it wouldn't really address illegal immigration through ports of entry, people who enter with, you know, with a fraudulent document. I mean, you know, one point to bear in mind on that is that people who enter legally and overstay their visas have been, you know, screened and determined to be admissible. So, you know, there's a reason that we should be a little bit more concerned about those who enter illegally, because we don't know anything about them and we do know something about visa overstayers. But in terms of addressing the large unauthorized population, visa overstayers are a significant part and one that we really haven't focused on either in the debate or in legislative proposals.
When people come into the U.S. illegally, where are they going and how has that changed over the years? It's not just along the border these days. It's not just California and Texas and Arizona. They're making their way much further into the country, right?
Right. Yeah, that's a huge trend that goes back several decades, both for lawful immigrants and for unauthorized immigrants. Traditionally, the overwhelming majority were in about six traditional immigration states: California, Texas, New York, Illinois, Florida, and New Jersey. But today, they're really diffused. There's a significant number of unauthorized immigrants in 41 different states and 137 different counties. And significant numbers in newer immigration states like Georgia has just under 400,000 unauthorized immigrants. North Carolina is a significant state for unauthorized immigration. Arizona has recently gotten a large unauthorized population.
And do we know what's happened with crime in those states with more unauthorized immigrants?
There's a lot of research that looks at criminality among the foreign-born population in general. It's a little bit hard to zero in on the unauthorized population, but there's some research that tries to look at that. What we know from the research is that immigrants commit crimes at lower rates, much lower rates than U.S. natives. Hmm. You know, when you look at arrests, when you look at incarcerations, when you look at incarcerations for serious crimes, on all of those indicators, foreign-born are lower than native-born in terms of their representation. And from what we can tell, unauthorized immigrants probably are even low within the foreign-born population. And one reason for that is that the stakes are very high for especially unauthorized immigrants because they'll get deported if they commit a crime,
right,
especially a serious crime.
And what about the jobs that they are taking in the U.S.?
Well, the number one job for unauthorized immigrants is construction. About 14% of unauthorized immigrants work in construction, followed by low-skilled manufacturing, services, food services. People think of unauthorized immigrants and immigrants in general working in agriculture. It's actually a small share of the foreign-born population, but that's mostly because there's very few people employed in agriculture. So immigrants make up a large share of the agricultural workforce, but that's a small share of all immigrants.
When you hear politicians say our immigration system is broken, do you agree with that assessment?
Well, there's two ways that it clearly seems to be broken. One is that we spend billions of dollars on immigration enforcement. We spend about $18 billion a year on immigration enforcement, which is more than all other federal criminal law enforcement agencies combined. So we spend more on immigration than on DEA, Secret Service, FBI, the U.S. Marshals combined. Yet despite all that spending, you know, we still have an unauthorized population of about 11 million. So something's not working. And another way in which it's broken is that the waits to get a legal visa for people who are entitled to a visa and who have been approved for a visa, the wait times, you know, I mentioned that it's about a 10-year wait for employment-based visas, but it can be a 25- or 30-year wait for a family-based visa. So between the time that somebody gets approved for a green card and they receive that green card can easily be a 20 or 25 or 30 year wait. So
and yet people are willing to do it in a lot of cases.
Well, I mean, people get on that list. A lot of the unauthorized population includes people who are on that list and who are waiting for their green card. And also we believe a lot of unauthorized immigrants who have already been approved for a green card and may have had their number come up. But once they've gotten here illegally, they can't then redeem their visa because in order to claim their visa, they would present themselves as being in the U.S. and therefore become inadmissible to get the visa.
How desirable a place is the U.S. now for an immigrant? If you're looking around the world and saying, where can I go to have a better shot at things?
I mean, the U.S. is still, you know, easily the number one destination when you look at absolute numbers. And there are regularly opinion polls conducted in other countries. And you see large numbers of people indicating that they would like to move to the U.S. if they had a chance to. For high-skilled immigrants, the United States is attractive because of our university system and because of our business climate and the opportunities to be entrepreneurial here. And for low-skilled immigrants, it's desirable, partly because we don't do a good job of enforcing worksite laws that make it illegal to hire an unauthorized immigrant. So there are opportunities here.
That's Mark Rosenblum, the deputy director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And the conversation continues online at hereandnow.org. Tomorrow, we'll continue our series on immigration with two people who came here without the proper documents.
You are in constant fear of driving without a license, fear that when you're working, immigration is going to make a raid, that somebody's going to get angry with you and they're going to call immigration on you.
That's tomorrow on Here and Now. Honeybee populations have been plummeting for nearly a decade in the U.S., but now two scientists in Washington State are teaming up to help the pollinator, and they're investigating an unusual source for the remedy, mushrooms. Ken Christensen of Here and Now contributor EarthFix has more.
Eric Olson clutches the lid on top of his wooden beehive. He slowly lifts it up and peeks inside.
Wow! Very nice.
Olson has been a beekeeper in eastern Washington for half his life.
Look at that!
He loves spending time with his bees, especially when they're doing well.
These girls are fantastic. They're making honey and they're making babies.
But just months ago, Olson and his team discovered that nearly half the bees in his 18,000 hives were dead. Olson wasn't alone. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that nearly half of honeybee colonies across the country collapsed in the past year. Big losses have been happening for nearly a decade, and scientists haven't determined what's causing them. More than 60 factors may play a role in collapsing colonies. Factors like pesticides, stress, and loss of habitat.
If we don't find some answer, I am really concerned about whether these little girls will survive.
But one unlikely source of help for the honeybee maybe growing close by. Paul Stamets tromps through the underbrush of the forests of western Washington. He spots a mushroom growing out of the side of a tree.
All right. Here's a great mushroom.
Stamets is a pioneer in the study of mushrooms. He snaps the mushroom off the tree, then he wraps it in wax paper to take back to his lab. He'll turn the mushroom into an extract.
I use mycology and the use of fungi to help clean up the environment and improve the immune system of animals, including people. I began to think, you know, I bet you I can do something to help the bees.
Stamets recently partnered with Steve Shepard, a bee expert at Washington State University. They think that fungus might give the honeybee two weapons in a fight against its worst enemy. That's a disease-carrying bug called the varroa mite. Shepard says that varroa mites invade hives, feast on bee blood, and transmit a slew of viruses to their hosts. Outside his lab near the Idaho border, Shepard crouches so he can peer into a stack of wooden bee boxes. He extends his bare hand and plucks a bee from one of the hives. He quickly spots a varroa mite.
You see her?
He bags a few hundred bees from the hive. Back at the lab, he transfers them to little plastic cages. Finally, he fills feeding tubes with a few drops of murky brown juice made from mushrooms. It comes from the lab of Paul Stamets, the mushroom expert who's working with Shepard. They're finding that the mushrooms are reducing viruses in bees. Next, Shepard and Stamets will test a different type of fungus to see if they can attack the mite directly.
It's certainly encouraging so far.
Shepard and Stamets plan to expand both experiments by partnering with commercial beekeepers.
Wow, I'm really tickled with this.
Like Eric Olson.
We just can't seem to get a control on the varroa mite. We've got our fingers crossed.
If the mushroom extract can help fend off varroa mites, Olson says the solution could find its way into beehives across the country. For Here and Now, I'm Ken Christensen.
When you think of American music, what comes to mind? There's Bob Dylan, Miles Davis, Whitney Houston, but we've been asking musicians around the country for their thoughts on that. And our next guest was born in Los Angeles, the son of two immigrants. When he was 18 years old, he moved to New York to form one of the most influential indie rock bands of the early 2000s. He sat down with us to answer the question, what does American music mean to him?
When I use the term Americana, I just think of, I guess it could be anything, a look, a sound. You know, for some reason, whenever I see, like, vast land that has a certain light and color to it, it feels very American. Hello, my name is Albert Hammond Jr., I live in New York City. I play in a band called The Strokes, and I also have just released a third solo album under my name called Momentary Masters. I'm an Aries. My birthday is April 9th. Well, my first pick has got to be one of my favorite songs of all times, but it evokes more of a street storytelling feeling of America. It's Lou Reed's Street Hassle. So quite the opposite of everything I just said, which is a theme in my life.
Wasn't Matilda without her wallet? The sexy boy smiled in dismay. She took out 420s cause she liked round figures. Everybody's free for a day. Oh, babe, I'm on fire and you know I admire your body. Why don't we slip away? Although I'm sure you're certain it's a rarity, me flirting, sha-la-la-la this way.
Oh, wow, I just got goosebumps from that. I was like, wait, that's not the beginning. And then I just forgot how much I love that song. And then I was actually thinking, what does that, why did I pick that? I don't know, there's a certain attitude to it that just, I don't know, I don't think that's what he was doing, but to me it just feels like, you know, anything feels possible, or maybe that's what those goosebumps are. It really hits me, and like, I'm entertained and I'm also moved. America.
Hey man, that's just a lie. That's why she tells her friends. It's a real song, a real song that she wouldn't even admit to herself. It's beating in her heart. It's a song lots of people know. It's a painful song. We'll always say the truth. The last four sad songs, a penny for a wish. Wish it won't make it, soldier. With a pretty kiss, with a pretty face, can't have its way. Don't trans like us, we were born to be.
And funny enough, that's Bruce Springsteen at the end of the song. They were in the studio there, and he sang that part at the end. It's like three parts, you know, and the reason why I bring it up, not only because that's awesome, but because my next song is Born to Run.
It's a suicide rap, we gotta get out, walk.
My dad had this Born to Run shirt that he bought when I guess he saw him during that tour. And him coming to America, or being a foreigner and becoming American, was such a thing. So it reminds me of that, me wearing the shirt and stuff like that. My mom too also became an American, so nothing to do with the shirt, but I don't know, it just all ties in maybe subconsciously, besides everyone feeling that Springsteen is, you know, an American legend, icon, dream. Kind of grew into that rugged everyman. Maybe that's what makes him American. My third pick was, and is, Jeff Buckley, Hallelujah.
Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing high.
This song, I remember exactly when when I first heard this song. I think it was 16, 17, exactly. I'm giving you a 2-year period, 16 to 18. I think it was 18. My neighbor came over and played me this song, and I think Candy Says, or Pale Blue Eyes. And our mom had just passed away, and we had this little crush, and we were just sitting there in the dark, and we play these songs on repeat. Hallelujah especially. And I don't know, I didn't know anything about the person or the song, but it was just to me, it felt breathtaking. The words, the melody, the performance, everything about it just seemed very magical, and it still does.
Baby, I've been here before. I've seen this room and I've walked this floor. You know, I used to live alone before I knew you. But I've seen your flag on the marble arch. And love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Well, if I had to choose my own song, I might have taken it out of the realm, or maybe there's a way that it can fit in it, and it worked somehow, but I picked a song off my new record called Coming to Get You.
One day soon, you'll have to leave. One day soon, you'll have to excuse me. Coming to get ya. Your knife's in the dresser, so perfect for fighting, so perfect for hiding. The anger won't let ya. They'll scream, but they'll get ya.
Yeah, it's just something with the melody and the words of the chorus that they remind me of, you know, the idea of being stuck in transit. Just you can take it literally, or just like, you know, when you pass away, you're just kind of stuck in a movement through something. And so, and I just like, you know, in dreams you're never 80. I just like the idea of, like, I don't know, time, life goes on, but you never, it's like you're never prepared for it.
Albert Hammond Jr. of The Strokes. His new solo album is called Momentary Masters. You can find this American playlist and many more at our website, hereandnow.org. And let us know what you think when you think of American music. That's at hereandnow.org.
Kids in some parts of the country are heading back to school today. And according to a recent study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they're starting their day too early. The CDC's report lands in the middle of a big debate. There's even a Maryland-based nonprofit, StartSchoolLater.net, that lays out why the morning bell should be delayed, including that teens in particular just can't get to sleep early enough at night and aren't awake when school starts at 7 a.m. Dr. Ann Wheaton is an epidemiologist at the CDC's Division of Population Health, lead author of this new study. So, Dr. Wheaton, just tell us, when on average does school start now, and when does the CDC think it should start?
Well, the average start time for middle and high schools, which are the key population we're looking at, is a little bit after 8 in the morning. And last fall, the American Academy of Pediatrics made a recommendation that middle and high schools start at 8:30 or later. And we found that about 5 out of 6 of these schools were starting too early.
Well, so what's the impact on kids, first of all, of schools starting too early? What do you think happens?
Well, it really affects kids across every aspect of their lives. So it affects their health. Kids that don't get enough sleep are more likely to be overweight, get less physical activity, and this can lead to diabetes, of course, hypertension. But it also affects their safety. They're more likely to experience injuries. Drowsy driving is an issue. But it also affects their academics. So, of course, for students, that's a big concern. And if they're supposed to be sleeping, you know, when class is starting, then that's definitely going to affect their learning.
And teenagers in particular seem to need more sleep. How many hours of sleep should teens get?
Just recently, the National Sleep Foundation made a recommendation that teens, so that's like 14, 17 high school students, should be getting 8 to 10 hours. But a lot of kids need to be getting at least 9 hours. So 8 might not be enough for a lot of them.
Well, so let's look at some of the arguments against pushing the school day back to accommodate that, to give teens more sleep. A lot of people say just make them go to sleep earlier at night. And it's the parents' fault, by the way, if they have these devices and other things that mean they can't get to sleep, or if they have too much homework, that's the school's fault. And that's why they're not going to sleep. Talk about whether or not kids, teenagers in particular, can go to sleep earlier. Can they physically go to sleep earlier?
Well, one of the earliest changes that happens during puberty is this delay in the sleep cycle, so that kids really can't fall asleep before maybe 11 o'clock at night.
Really?
And they still need that 8-9 hours of sleep. And so they're still supposed to be asleep when they're starting school.
I know of several teenagers who are saying, see,
exactly.
I can't. Because what? They don't have enough of the melatonin that they need because their circadian rhythms are adjusting?
It's not so much how much melatonin they have. It's when it rises. So melatonin is associated with sleep. And it starts to rise in the evening and it peaks in the middle of the night. And this is what's shifting. This is what I was referring to as this sleep cycle shift. In the evening, it starts to rise later than it did when they were younger.
Well, some other concerns are if kids are coming to school later, and some schools have changed to 9 o'clock in the morning. I mentioned that website, the StartSchoolLater.net. They cite Santa Rosa County, Florida. They now start their high schoolers between 9 and 9:25 a.m. The elementary schools start at 7:30 a.m., and a lot of districts are doing that. They're flipping so that the younger kids start earlier, the older kids get the later start and a little more sleep. But a recent survey of teachers in Montgomery County, Maryland, for instance, 50-60% oppose the early start time. They say, you know, low-income families have kids who have to work after-school jobs. If the school day shifted, they can't do that. What about extracurricular activities? How late do they go? And these teachers, at least 50-60% of them, didn't feel that it would help with some of the issues of fatigue. Your thoughts?
Well, one concern is that people fear that teens will just end up going to sleep later.
In other words, if they're staying up till 11, if they think they have an hour more in the morning, they'll stay up till 12 or 1 o'clock.
Right. So that is a legitimate concern. But a lot of studies that have been done in delaying school start times have found that that's not the case. Bedtimes don't really end up changing that much.
Well, and another thing people say is, back in our day, we used to do it, you know, walk 10 miles to the country school or something. But traditionally, when did schools start in America?
Well, we don't have that much information. Actually, this survey is the first real good data that we have nationwide. But smaller studies have shown that school start times have been getting earlier and earlier the past few decades.
Yeah. So parents, think again. Did you really go to school at 7 in the morning? Maybe not. That's Dr. Ann Wheaton of the CDC. Dr. Wheaton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, for their study, the CDC did look at the schools that have changed to a later start time. Every public school in Ohio except Parma, the Fairfax County and Arlington public schools in Virginia. And the CDC found that across the board, kids fared better.
There are a lot of questions maybe from parents about whether they can wait until later to take the kids to school.
Go to work late. Weigh in at hearnow.org. Here Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.